Good afternoon, Supervisor Idle.
Good afternoon, Daniel. How are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good.
Good. Well, I'll tell you, I love this weather. You get the rain and everything gets all the ground, everything gets saturated, and then the sun comes out. It's just beautiful right now. So
yeah, it's pretty nice out. I meant to take a walk earlier and my work well did not permit it, but I'll take one this evening, I think. So
Yeah, we need a lot more rain, but this is encouragement that spring is coming. It's nice in feel. Motion. So yep.
Yeah.
All good. Hi, David. How are you?
Afternoon, gang. Doing well. Lori, you can sympathize. I'm coming off knee replacement surgery, but we're back up and ready. Yeah. So it's all good.
I've had two brothers that have gone through that and several friends, but they've all been very successful. So
Worthwhile pain.
When was that? When did you have yours?
It was about 10 days ago.
Awesome. Isn't it amazing? Yeah.
We're past the wicked drugs and the wicked pain, so it's all good.
Yeah. It's weird because I had all the empty bottles and I went, oh my God, look at all this stuff.
Yeah.
But you have to get back out and get exercising because it's amazing how fast those muscles atrophy and you just don't have that same strength and stuff. So got to work it up.
Absolutely. Well, and speaking of that, John, I have to jump off at 4 o'clock because I've got Monday, Wednesday, Friday physical therapy sessions, and they'll beat me with a stick if I miss a physical therapy session.
Okay, very good. And I appreciate you letting us know because I've got a question for you before you leave. So we'll wait till we get through that part of the agenda. If not, I'll jump ahead. But it just has to do with the zoning thing and whether or not you think the planning commission, in addition with our ag commission, not planning commission, but the ag commissioners, in addition with our ag commissioner, would be able to look at appropriate setbacks on a case-by-case basis, or if that's too onerous, but we'll get to that.
I'm sure Charlene will weigh in.
Yes. Myrna, looks like you want to talk. No.
No, I'm going to be muted. I'm going to go to mute mode.
Okay, fair enough.
I think everything's out there for you. And you got those last two notes I just sent you?
I've not seen them if you just sent me. I was doing something out there a few minutes ago. So.
Okay, I sent them to, probably not directly to you. I sent them to BOS4 and BOS1. Dave Hardy had a comment. He had a couple on zoning and parcel size, and I sent that, and it is worth reading into. And then also Casey had a note that he wanted read into it. So I'd be glad to read it in if you want me to.
Okay, yeah, we'll do that.
When it comes to that time.
Yep, okay. Very good. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
So Charlene, do you know that we're waiting for anyone? I think we have the critical mass, and obviously more people will be joining, but...
Yeah, I think we can okay. Start.
All right. So I want to welcome everybody to our second hemp ad hoc public meeting. And we're returning, obviously, from having a meeting about 3 weeks ago, I think it was. I don't remember the exact date, but we're going to continue the conversation. Hopefully everybody got a copy of the agenda, which Myrna and Charlene put together and was sent out. It has three items on it. So we're going to follow that unless we find reason to change that for some reason. But with everybody's basically agreement, we're going to follow the agenda because I think we're much more constructive with our time if we do that. So with that, we've done introductions in the past. I don't want to repeat that. I will just mention that Supervisor Parlin and I are the two representatives from the board on the ad hoc committee. Charlene and Daniel really represent staff from the standpoint of our ag commissioner and then also our county council in terms of laws and regulations coming from the state and federal government. Lieutenant Cook is with us from the sheriff's office as well. Sorry, Lieutenant, I had to do the reset here, but so he's here to comment on that as well. And then what I'd like to do is just ask anyone who was not at the last meeting, wasn't able to introduce yourself at the last meeting and identify what organization you're with, to please take the time to share that with us now so that new participants, we understand the name and the organization or the individual that's being represented. So Is there anyone online with us today who was not present at the last meeting? Okay, I'm not seeing anyone acknowledging that. So I think we'll go ahead and proceed then. So with that, we'll take on item one, hemp updates, state and federal. Pardon? Mark.
Yes, Mark Cluster, SPI is on here.
All right, thank you. So we're going to start with item one, hemp update, state and federal. And I, Daniel prepared a summary for us. It's titled State Regulations. So hopefully you got all got a copy of his PowerPoint. And with that, Daniel, I assume you're going to kind of lead us through that.
Yeah, I will. And I think the, you know, the message I wanted to send here is that we do in fact have, I know I had mentioned before that we had some pending state and federal regulations. They have both become final. The federal regulations, I'm still somewhat wrestling with fully understanding about what the difference between that one and the one that was pending. But I went ahead and just kind of did a summary of what the state regulations for and I figured a PowerPoint is a good way of doing so. So I'm going to go ahead and share my screen, launch this. There we go. All right. Guys, kind of start out at the, just to, you know, one thing to say at the beginning of this is that this is kind of informational purposes only for the committee. I know members of the public are here, different people interested in the industry. This is not in any way indicated to give them particular legal advice. I really encourage them, if they had questions, go to an attorney. And I included a website, the link to the CDFA's website here on that you can have a, you can find a copy of all the regulations and different forms that I mentioned. So I'm just gonna go through kind of the process that is set out in state regulation, because I think it's important for our discussions, because some of this stuff is things that have been touches on previous discussions we've had. In general, these are the requirements that the regulations have for what goes into the application. Most of this is pretty straightforward. One thing that might be important for us to recognize here is they do have a requirement in their application that says the cultivation site is not on a premises licensed to cultivate cannabis. And so that is something that could be relevant to particular people. Other than that, this is a the one thing I will note here that I'll bring up again in a second. Well, the this idea of what a key, that it also requires this criminal history report for each key recipient, participant. And what that really means is the criminal history report is a FBI identity history summary. A key participant means every person who essentially had executive managerial capacity, or was intended to have executive managerial capacity in the particular applicant. And the reason why that's important is that if that criminal history report reveals that the person has a disqualifying conviction, then that person cannot participate in a hemp program for 10 days from 10 years, not 10 days, from the date of that conviction. And they list out in the regulations what is the disqualifying conviction, which is a plea of guilty or nolla contendere of any for any state or federal felony related to a controlled substance. So that's something that would come into play during the application process. And just a brief note that they have a list of where their approved seed cultivators are. It's not really something the county has a major play in, but noting it to people anyway. Also, the one thing that does touch on something that we've discussed is the state regulations do require the commissioner to conduct annual inspections for these purposes, which is does touch on many things that have been brought up in the public comment there. To verify the registration information, confirm crop destruction, ensure appropriate record keeping. So the regulations do in, contemplate that there will be regular inspections from the Ag Commissioner. Now I'm kind of trying to keep this in chronological order, so theoretically, of how this process would work. Presuming you have an application, what the other step of it here is, regulations require all the people who have registered, who have an application, registrants to submit a signed planting report to the commissioner within 72 hours following the completion of planting. There's a template for that report over on their website. And that it also authorizes, but doesn't require the commissioner to conduct field inspections to confirm the planting report. So that's another time where the regulations do in fact talk about inspections. Now this is, I think, probably the newest part of the regulations. This was mentioned before, but they kind of did tease out more detail to the concept of sampling and testing. And I'm kind of putting it in what I believe the chronologic order of what that step would be. It starts with that a registrant has to submit this pre-harvest report for each planting at least 20 calendar days before the anticipated harvest date. And that includes this other sample analysis request form for each composite sample to be taken. Those are both forms on CDFA's website. Then the regulations contemplate a host of people who could have done the testing. So I just listed them all out there. And those are usually done 6 calendar days before the anticipated harvest date where they take the sampling. And then the samples have to be delivered to approved laboratories, which are laboratories that meet certain requirements, and then essentially tested to confirm that THC concentration is appropriate. The laboratory then will issue a test back to both the registrant and the commissioner, as well as the USDA. You'll either pass or fail. If the registrant gets a passing test, they have to harvest within 72 hours. Oh, sorry, no, they have to harvest within 15 calendar days from the sampling date. They have to submit a harvest report within 72 hours following the completion of the harvest. If they fail, there is a process depending on the type of how much the fail date, the fail amount was, that they could ask for one more test. Otherwise, the crop has to be destroyed. And they also, in the regulations, created a separate process for abatement enforcement, which essentially creates this idea of that if there is plants that are not in compliance with state and federal law, the cultivator has to destroy them. They have to create a destruction plan that the commissioner has to approve. And then they submit a later destruction report back to the commissioner, just confirming destruction. And then the commissioner has to confirm that in fact the crops were destroyed by doing a field inspection. So like, that was a lot of information. So does either Heidel or Supervisor Heidel or Parlin, do you have questions?
I want to just ask Charlene first if she has any comments on this. I'm sure she's familiar with it like you are, but you have any comments, Charlene?
Well, just the fact that the USDA final rule did get published on January 15th, it is going to change some things again. The window between sample collection and harvest, the final rule went back to 30 days. They were at 15, which is why the state plan was at 15. Another thing, sampling methods overall are very similar, but now the final rule has an allowance for a performance-based sampling protocol. And it has to have also a confidence level of 95%. So we're not exactly sure what that means and what kind of protocol. So that's something to be kind of delved into later. The testing laboratories still are required to be DEA registered. So that remained the same. And with the state rules, they just kind of put a thing in there with you have to go look at the federal rules to see whether you need to do that or not. The one thing that did come out of this is they have found that there's not enough DEA registered laboratories yet across the nation. So the DEA has agreed to extend the enforcement flexibility, so allowing non-DEA registered labs to test hemp until January 1st, 2022. I think the state's encouraging everybody because it does take probably, it's about a 6-month process to get DEA registered. So the states were, suggesting everybody get on it as quickly as possible. One thing the final rule also did is that originally the interim rule had a, what we'll call a negligence threshold. of 0.5% for THC levels. So anything above that was considered negligent and could be held against you if you wanted to continue in the program. They did raise that to 1% THC level, which pretty much is where the state was looking at it anyway. So there's not a lot of change there for the state. And they also did kind of go into some more on disposal of plants that tested over the 0.3% and what could be done to dispose of them. And also they now put in some remediation that could be done for the plants. So it's rather limited, but there is something now. So I was on a state call earlier this afternoon, and so the state is analyzing these changes that the federal rule has, and they did state that they are planning to do any updates they need to do through the regular rulemaking process, not any emergency rulemaking. So that's where we're at.
All right, thank you for those comments. I'm constantly changing, that's what I'm hearing, right? It's,
yes.
We're not through this yet, we're still in this mode of flux. It's going to change again, I'm sure, and then we'll have to readjust and communicate to everybody. But with that, Lori, do you have any particular comments on the presentation that Daniel just gave?
I just had a general question for Charlene. You know, when you go through this presentation and it has so many deadlines and timelines and you know, some tight windows and stuff, do you anticipate that you're going to need more staff to implement, you know, to keep up with all of these tight windows of, you know, I'm just curious. I don't know how the workflow will go for you and all that.
And a lot of it's going to depend on interest. You know, we've been able to go along with the amount of registrants we've had so far. I could see that if we had a large increase of interest in registrants, it could put an additional stress on our department.
So you have an idea of, well, so right now you had, what was it, 12, 13?
So we have 10 permanent and one limited term.
Okay, so and you were able to keep up with that. Do you see a number that could be the breaking point where you'd need more staff? I mean, I don't know how to...
And I would say, because we had really 10, I would say that really did anything, it could be two ports. If we get a lot more registrants, so I could see possibly some issues even if we got to 20, or if we had a large amount of acreage, that could cause an issue too, because even with now we're going to be having to work under this 15-day harvest period, which is going to be a hard thing to deal with anyway until the state changes this. Mm-hmm. Because probably what will happen is the registrants will have to break up their plots that they're doing into individual sections, shall I say, because it'll just be rather difficult probably to get, you know, too much of a size of acreage done in that 15 days in a harvest. So that will add to the workload, yes.
Okay, thank you. Oh, John, you're on mute.
Thank you. I had some background noise, so I wanted to mute it here. But thank you. So my question is on the abatement and enforcement, because obviously this puts, again, like Lori was asking, quite a bit of responsibility on the commissioner to follow through and make sure all these things happen if it is determined the crop has to be destroyed because of high THC, whatever it is. And then, you know, there's always a voluntary compliance, which would make things easier for everybody, but I'm not sure that's always going to be the vehicle that gets applied. So I'm a little concerned about, you know, what workload that might create, hoping not a lot, but not being aware of it. And then the other question I have, which kind of gets into the higher THC cannabis, is as Lieutenant Cook talked about last year, they found that there were some grows of hemp that were going on that included the normal high THC cannabis, and that had to be eradicated. And I assume they take everything out when they do that. would that then be some kind of a violation of the way this enforcement is written, that it has to be done by the commissioner, the ag commissioner, as opposed to a law enforcement agency?
Well, under the new federal rules, there's a little more flexibility, and that's why they allowed some additional disposal means.
Okay.
So now that the grower could dispose of it on their own, you know, growing property, and by different methods, deep burial, they could disc it in, shred it, plow it in. They can do some different things like that. So it doesn't necessarily have to be removed from the property.
All right. And that would probably be the more organic way to dispose of it if it's done, you know, according to, you know, proper best practices in terms of crop cultivation, destruction, whatever you want to call it. So, okay.
Yeah, and Supervisor Idle, I just want to point out, because I think one of the sentences, my slide is confusing. When the sentence that begins with cultivator may also voluntarily destroy, that refers to that, I think I tried to paraphrase something in probably a way that didn't quite on track. That's if someone decides that they don't want a portion of their crop and they want to destroy it, it's more of a limitation on how they can destroy it. So when we're getting to the point of abatement enforcement, we're really talking about that these are crops that we have, for one reason or another, have determined are in violation of state or federal law, and we're that they're being required to destroy it. So,
right, voluntary tends to be, let's say they got aphids like crazy, and so they couldn't sell the crop. You know,
yeah, and it's just like that. It's setting a method on for. Even in that instance, it's saying that they have to destroy crops in a particular way. So.
Got it. Okay. That helps. I appreciate the clarification on that.
Yeah.
So with that, let's open it up to any of the panelists who might have questions on this, to either Daniel or Charlene. Anybody? I'm not seeing raised hands. So I think we're good with this. Let's see. We have one raised hand, it looks like, right? Lee.
Yeah. Yes, it's Lee Tannenbaum. Daniel, maybe you can help me understand this. So the federal government will allow for I don't remember what page it was, but it talked about the background check. And I remember having to do this since I grew hemp last year. But the criminal history report is required. And I'm wondering if you know, because I'm in the process of also applying for my cannabis license, why the federal government and, you know, CDFA would accept an FBI history check that we can pull on our own, yet the county of El Dorado will not do that for a cannabis applicant. And if you don't know the answer, that's fine, but that kind of baffles me that the USDA will accept it, but our county will not.
Well, I'll say that I want to avoid on commenting on the cannabis program, because I think I want to, you know, keep within the confines of the hemp ad hoc committee, because we're, to avoid a Brown Act violation, we need to make sure we stay this consistent with hemp. But on the question on the FBI identity history review summary, that's a function of federal law, because the federal statutes and regs specifically authorize access to the FBI identity history summary and the usage of that to hemp. And there's no such federal law to cannabis currently, because hemp does have a separate status. Does that kind of answer your question on how we're doing then hemp? But I just want to make sure.
Yes, thank you.
Okay, sure.
All right, I'm not seeing any other
Mr. Miller.
Comments. Yeah, okay. I'm not seeing any other comments or questions from panelists, so I think we can go ahead.
We have Rod Miller, sorry.
Okay, Rod, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just wondering if the new federal regs adopted January 15th, if they preempted the state regulations.
Well, this is a... Wow. Not exactly. How shall I put this? Ultimately, the state plans will have to meet the federal plans. Now, since California has already submitted their state plan, USDA is essentially working with them to And they understand with these changes too, that it may, all states may have to do some changes. So they allow some time to do that. And during that time, we would be ultimately operating under the state plan. With the, you know, like I said, with the idea that the states will have to amend their current plan to meet the federal rule.
Hopefully that answers the question, Rod. And it's all very confusing.
Yes, thank you. Yes. Thank you very much.
Okay, then with that, let's move on to item two, which is review the survey requested by the ad hoc committee the last time around. And Myrna has put together a matrix that shows the basic responses. And I understand, Myrna, there were two additional responses that came in this afternoon, I guess. So we can add those. But Myrna, do you want to kind of summarize this, or do you want me to just kind of walk through it, or what do you recommend at this point?
Oh, I'm not sure, because each one of them kind of was a little bit different, and the ones right. that I need to add to are parcel size and setbacks. So okay. I won't need to add until then, and that's from Mr. Hardy. And then also Casey just had a statement, so we can okay. save that for later.
All right, so I'm going to ask you to bring that up, but I'm going to kind of summarize and walk through these then as kind of a lead on it. So
thank you.
I think we ought to start with zoning, because to me that's probably one of the least argumentative relative to the appropriate zonings. And I'll just volunteer, you know, where I'm coming from on this is I do believe that obviously the ag zonings are appropriate. So whether that's AG, PA, LA, they would seem to be appropriate. And large RL, because I think we have RL20, RL40, RL80, and I'm not sure at what level when I say large would be acceptable. So I do believe that rural lands is probably an acceptable zone for growing hemp, but there may be a minimum like RL40 or something that would make sense. Not having direct experience with this type of a product and the ag stuff. So that's kind of where I am with it. I believe all the ag zonings are appropriate. Somebody suggested the forest zonings, but not TPZ. And I'm not sure how prevalent hemp applications for forest zonings, maybe that will occur. Again, I just don't know how many forest zonings we have that have soils and sun exposure that would be conducive to growing hemp. Maybe there are some, or maybe there are several, but I think that would be into consideration. So that's kind of where I synthesized a lot of this in terms of the zoning, but I'd love to hear obviously from Charlene and then Daniel, if you have any comments, and then Lori, and kind of work through it. But relative to zoning, Charlene, what are your thoughts at this point?
And I concur with what you were saying. I would think that the ag zoning, rural lands, and once again, maybe it's a little bit larger parcels on the rural lands. Forest zones, looking at the zoning matrix, it does allow crop production, orchards and vineyards. So, you know, I think that could work also, depending on, you know, how the soils are and things like that. So I agree with you.
All right, Daniel, do you have any comments on this one?
No, not really. I tend to agree with that. I mean, when I look through the how other counties have dealt with it, that's generally what they've concluded. So,
okay. Lori, your thoughts?
No, that makes sense along those lines. I'm just not sure about but size is a separate thing we're going to talk about, right? So
yes, yeah, parcel size is separate. So we're dealing with each four elements individually. I think that's probably reasonably. So I'm going to go to David. David, what are your thoughts? You're probably a lot more familiar with most of these zonings and what really fits and what doesn't than a lot of us. So what are your thoughts on this?
No, I agree. I think the ag zoning designations are the appropriate places to grow the crop. Certainly RL, but as you mentioned, maybe a little larger parcel size. In terms of the timber zoning, I think maybe some of the people in the industry could weigh on in this question. But I think as a practical matter, as a horticultural matter, I think most of those zoning designations are at higher elevations above 3,000 feet, and I don't think you're going to see a lot of growing sites at higher elevation.
Okay, very good. So I think we're all consistent with our thoughts on that. So at this point, I'll turn it over to any of the other panelists who would like to comment on, you know, the general discussion of zoning and the categories that we just felt or just expressed were probably the most applicable. So anybody have challenges to that or additions? I don't think general residential property applies at all for hemp growing. I just don't see that being practical. So comments from the panelists, anyone? Okay, Lee's saying agreed. All right, so it looks like without any, Jennifer, go ahead.
Oh, hi. Okay, so what about the properties that are ag zoned, but they're right next to a residential zoned across the street?
That would be in things like setbacks and other things, I think. So we're just talking zoning as a category. Where does it possibly apply? What zones would it be possible to grow hemp in? That's kind of the category we're taking this at. So I'm going to defer your question until we talk about setbacks, if that's okay.
That's perfect. Thank you.
Okay. Any other panelists' comments? All right. So seeing none, I think that's fairly convergent and conclusive. So let's move on to parcel size. And one of the individuals expressed that there's no need for a minimum parcel size. And that's kind of where I landed with it, with an emphasis on it. Really the setbacks are, and restrictions in terms of sensitive receptors and stuff are probably the biggest driver. And some one of the person commented on parcel size kind of bridged over into setbacks. So, but again, kind of separating them out, does anyone see the absolute necessity for a minimum parcel size to be established? You know, parcels no less than 5 acres. One person suggested 3 acres might be, and smaller might be too small. But I guess I just don't have a sense of that because it depends on the slopes on the property and how it's laid out and the proximity to other sensitive receptors or people, the remoteness of it. There seems to be a whole lot of other variables that would be more indicative of what should be the proper method to control as opposed to just parcel size. So at this point, I'm commenting in favor of not establishing a minimum parcel size, but use the other parameters that to really determine the appropriateness of any given proposed site. So Charlene, your thoughts on it?
Yeah, because I was also thinking, you know, we have different parcels that may be surrounded by Forest Service or different types of, you know, BLM or whatever, and they could be smaller size, but there's really nothing around them that would be an issue. So that makes sense.
Okay, so, Daniel.
Oops.
Sorry, Daniel, you have any comments on this one?
Only one quick one is that I think the only limitation that we would not be concerned about is in the Food and Ag Code 81006. They have a very small discussion here on, except when grown by a registered established agricultural research institution or a registered hemp breeder, industrial hemp shall be grown in acreages of not less than 1/10 of an acre at the same time. So it's not much of a limitation. If we are silent on it, that'd still be there. But just letting people know that's in the Food and Ag Code.
And I can't think of anyone trying to grow a product list on 1/10 of an acre because
I don't know why it would ever apply, but
I can't see it as a personal use product, but you know, for some kind, you're going to make rope or whatever it is, right? You're going to,
yeah,
make
it. I thought it was surprising when I said, I'm surprised the statute said anything on it, honestly, but it's there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Lori, your thoughts?
Yeah. I just was wondering, I was trying to get in the zoning code a little bit. And so I didn't get far enough. Sorry about that. But Charlene, is there a minimum parcel size for something to be considered ag anyway, or no?
Well, I would say in general, 10 acres is the typical, but I can tell you from working the Ag Commission stuff, there are a number of ag parcels that are smaller than that because of subdivision or whatever from earlier.
Oh my God. Okay. I was just wondering if there was like a built-in minimum anyway, but not necessarily. Okay.
So I did have the comment from
yes,
and it was just parcel size 5 acre minimum ag zone necessary for the grape vineyard winery tasting room and EDC is the model for economic viability. This minimum small production scale 5 acres for hemp cultivation in the county should be used as a basis of county hemp production policy. small cultivation production and utilization of local cooperative processing and extraction facilities is the potential for our county to realize revenues that will be generated from this new industry. Thank you.
All right, thank you. So there's a 5-acre minimum suggestion. So let's open it up to other panelists for comments. Looks like we have two already. Jennifer first. Or is that a carryover, Jennifer?
Oh, that was a carryover. Sorry.
Okay. Down. Sorry.
No, no problem. Yeah. So Rod, I think you're up.
Yeah, the land use zoning designations pretty much create a standard for the minimum parcel size. RL properties have a lot of the ag activities permitted under the zoning matrix, like animal raising, dairy, that kind of thing. There's no minimum parcel sizes for those types of activities. So to be consistent with the other parts of the zoning code, your suggestion makes sense.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. David.
Yeah, John, I think, you know, one of the distinctions between our winery ordinance and the ranch marketing ordinance is that, you know, we have the minimum parcel size, but we also have a minimum acreage that you're required to grow as permanent crop, whether it's a vineyard or orchard crop, to meet the ordinances. And the reason is because it's pretty easy to substitute. If you're a grower, and if you don't really want to grow a lot of orchard crop or vineyard, you know, you can grow 2 acres of vineyard and go buy the rest. Well, of course, in the hemp business, you can't do that. So I think the economic viability is really going to drive the, you know, the minimum parcel size. I, you know, maybe Phil and Casey and the folks on the and Lee can weigh in, but I can't imagine that anything less than a 3 or 4 acre grow site would be a viable business.
Yeah, and I think I would agree with you. And the other thing is orchards and vineyards are long-term investments. You know, and obviously hemp is an annual crop. So you're planting it, you're harvesting it. Maybe you start small with a pilot grow and then you expand it, whatever. But you generally don't do that with orchards or vineyards. You make a commitment of a major acreage. And if that's successful, maybe you do a similar block later or something. But it's kind of a different category the way I see it. So, all right. Any other, Lee? Yes.
Yeah. So, I'm with Dave in that as a hemp grower, you have to grow a certain amount in order to actually make money. And most people that are going to grow hemp that want to actually make real, you know, kind of cash from it are going to grow 2 or more acres because of the low sale value of hemp in the marketplace. And the one thing, John, I do want to sort of push back on is that it could be a year-round crop if somebody were to invest in greenhouses. Although,
okay,
from a business perspective and from weighing that out, I don't see that happening, but maybe. But it could be a year-round crop. I agree with Dave in that, you know, if you really want to make money growing hemp, like support your living, you're going to have to grow a fairly significant amount.
Okay. Yeah, I don't see us having to legislate a minimum parcel size.
Right. So I think that's kind of the conclusion here is we can maybe just ignore parcel size, at least initially, but recognizing whenever we have an ordinance, if we find there's flaws in it, we can go back as the board and change it to put something in. But I'd rather go on the lighter side as opposed to over-regulating things. That's just, I think, better for trying to promote an agricultural product if you still view it that way. So, okay. So I think we've had a good discussion on the parcel size. General consensus is it's something we probably don't need to include a minimum right now. And I don't see a maximum making any sense. You know, if somebody has large plots of lands and this is what they want to grow, provided they meet all the other regulations, you know, I don't see this, you know, sky's the limit in terms of maximum, in my opinion. So I think all we were talking about is the minimum relative to parcel size. So that said, I think the most subjective discussion then is in setbacks, because there's been a lot of different ideas suggested. You know, and knowing the variability of all these different properties, the location, the sensitivity to residents, those kinds of things, I think it's going to be very hard to write a conforming set of setbacks that would apply everywhere with equal application. It's almost like if you establish a typical ag type of setback, at some given point, that's a harm to that particular parcel because there's nobody adjacent to them, or it's BLM land or whatever, right? And so why wouldn't you be able to grow right to the property line? And now, so now you're restricting, you know, the commerce part of this arbitrarily. And to me, it almost begs the option of doing an inspection and looking what are the local sensitive receptors, what is the elevation, what are the adjacent neighbors' proximity, what are the kinds of things that would cause conflict with the adjacent neighbors and stuff, and then establish setbacks accordingly. It might be a setback against one property line that might be 200 feet, and the other property lines, the setback is zero. So it almost seems to me like a special case type situation. If you try to prescribe something that's one size is going to fit all, we're going to find that it doesn't well. But that's my opinion. And then what that does is it puts an onus, I think, on our ag commissioner and our appointed ag commissioners to do a site inspection and really determine what are the appropriate setbacks for that. If there's a school within, 300 feet, that might have an influence on it because of the odor aspects of things. So everything I think is almost a special case with maybe a few exceptions. So that's my thought on that part of it. But by the same token, we can't have something that requires so much work that you can't effectively do it. But I will remind everybody, we have drones within the county. And I think those drones could be used to survey property lines, to look at adjacent things, to get a higher look elevation of what's going on in a given piece of property. I know the Sheriff's Department has drones. Our DA's organization has drones. Our Department of Transportation is purchasing a very large drone. So I think that would be an aid in terms of being able to surveil a large property without having to walk it per se and really understand what's out there from a topical view that would make sense. So I think those kinds of technologies and aids would be available. But that's kind of where I'm coming at the setback, because I think if we start prescribing things at some point, for a given application, it just isn't going to fit. So we'd have to consider variances to that. And I'd rather not consider variances if we can set it once right. And then on an annual basis, we'd have to probably go back out because there might be a new house that gets built right next to a piece of ag land that might be RL, and somebody builds a house 200 feet from the property line or something. So, but I just want to start by asking Charlene if she thinks that would be too onerous to ask for an inspection of each side to determine the applicability of appropriate setbacks.
Well, it definitely will be a lot of work. If we don't have a lot of registrants, I think it would be doable. If we start getting a lot of people with a lot of interest, then it's going to be difficult, I believe. Yeah.
Okay, and David, I'd like to hear from you too. I'm assuming Daniel doesn't have a comment on this one because it's kind of in a different category. But do you, Daniel?
I actually did want to make
one comment
going in, is that one thing I want to note as we're considering the issue of setbacks is that I also want to consider whether CEQA is intended to apply to these permits. And the reason why I bring this in is that depending on how you set out the permit and what its standards are, if it's set out in what is known as a ministerial fashion, where basically it means that those who are looking at the permit are checking off boxes, CEQA doesn't apply, and you've complied with CEQA. And if you do the kind of a more nuanced look at every project, that's kind of what, similar to how a specific use permit works, you may have to do CEQA implications. That could be something that could add to staff time. There's a cost and benefit to that, but I think it's something to consider going into this, is that the more, if you want to have a more nuanced look of every project, you may have CEQA implications, and that may add more time and, but I would imagine also increase the fees essentially, because they've and may end up having to even involve planning staff at that point, because that could, I don't know if the ag staff has looked at CEQA issues like that before. So
Charlene, would you care to comment on that one? That seems a little bit.
Well, in general, with what we've done is, planning has always been the one to look at the CEQA of the projects that we have that go through the Ag Commission. Mm-hmm.
So that's probably where that responsibility was reside with hemp as well as the others. But
I'm just noting that because I can say when we are creating a process, we can create a process to the ministerial and how it works. And that would reduce time in its review. The disadvantage of that is it's not going to be fact specific as much, but you could even create something that is sort of neutral in the sense of, you know, setback is this if this one thing occurs, but it's not a, it doesn't require a subjective look at that particular parcel. And there's no discretionary look there. You know, both approaches are fine. I just want to make sure that we're aware of that when we're starting out on this, because it, you know, depends on how you want to draft the process. So.
Got it. Yeah. I'm trying to think of how the cannabis is without talking cannabis. I'm trying to remember how we dealt with CEQA with a cannabis ordinance, but that would certainly be a reference to go back and.
I believe it requires a specific use permit. So there are some implications of the cannabis thing as far as I'm aware. You know, I don't want to go too far into that, but I believe there are CEQA implications of the cannabis applications. So.
Okay. Thank you. Yep. So Lori, your thoughts on setbacks.
Yeah. I thought we were trying to make something a little more ministerial. Was my thought, so that if we had, you know, some checks that, yeah, this is big enough and this is far enough from a sensitive receptor or something, that we could kind of check box it and get through it so that you didn't have to have a special use permit. And then I guess if somebody wanted to do something that doesn't fit the ministerial, they could apply for a special use permit. Is that kind of how it works then, Daniel? If
we could do that, yes. We could certainly draft it that way. And that would be what you'd look at, because the whole concept of ministerial and discretionary is a big deal in the CEQA world. But I would have to make sure that when we're looking at that, that essentially what the staff is asked to do is like, yeah, they're looking at a checkbox. And you can still set a setback that, you know, by effect is, does take into consideration of the unique nature of a particular parcel, because we could say that, you know, setback occurs if XYZ occurs, and that does sort of by implication go into that, but it's not necessarily like going to that parcel and looking at it and making a call on that parcel, because that's where the discretionary stuff would come in. If you wrote it in like, well, you know, you could go to the parcel, look at that, make a judgment of whether you think it's 50 to 100 or something like that, that becomes a discretionary process and you have potential CEQA implications. So but I could certainly draft it that way, and I just want to make it clear in the beginning which way we want to go, because it obviously things vary. So,
right, yeah, you know, just looking at the Excel spreadsheet that we got from all the other counties, there's so many different ways you could craft it, but it just seems like I think some of the comments that have been sent in over the last few weeks, you know, kind of had some suggestions. And potentially, if we could put those, what's the right word? I have to be careful with the words that you use. I was going to say common sense. That doesn't work because everybody's is different. But some, you know, some basic criteria, you know, so far from a sensor receptor or whatever, and then had those be ministerial. And then if somebody wants to do something that doesn't fit the ministerial, they can apply for a permit, a special use permit. And that's going to, though, cost them more money and it'll take more staff time and stuff, and they'll have more fees, but that's the choice. Then there's some choices here that maybe some could get ministerial approval, no problem. The location's far enough, nobody's concerned, that kind of thing. So that's just what I had in my mind. I don't know what everybody else was thinking.
Well, some of the comments mentioned BMPs and stuff, and that could certainly be written into it, but I'm not sure how widely understood, you know, best manufacturing practices are. For growing and stuff are distributed, knowledgeable, known throughout the growing industry, because for some cases there's probably a lot of knowledge there, and some cases there may be no knowledge there. So referencing BMP has to go with some specific document or something else, is my thought. It's got to be tied to something that's tangible that everybody can understand on an equal basis, and I don't know if that exists or not, but that's just another part of this. Okay, so with that, David, since I know you got a time limitation, your thoughts on setbacks here?
Yeah, sorry about that, John. Verizon decided to cut me off. Yeah, so I think it's a process of just finding a happy medium between, you know, I think we all agree one size fits all is not appropriate, and it should be more on a case by case basis. And on the other side, not going too far in terms of overloading Charlene and staff with you know, doing the like, boots on the ground work for every single parcel. But I think it starts with identifying, you know, first, what are the sensitive receptors, whether it's schools, houses, roads, et cetera. And from there, what, you know, what are appropriate setbacks?
Okay. I like that. Yep. Very good. So let's take comments from other panelists. Lee's first, it looks like. So go ahead.
Yeah, thanks. My comment on this one is, and I'm in agreement with, you know, sort of the list mentality and what Dave said. I don't see a need for setbacks, but I know we need to have at least a minimum. But then if we could add to that things like where's the close, you know, you must be no closer than X number of feet from a sensitive receptor, whatever that is, then you could say, okay, well, we're not going to have setbacks on hemp as long as it meets, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4 criteria, whatever that is. And it would then be a checklist as opposed to a subjective thing. And that seems to make the most sense to me on this. Now, again, I don't fall into any of the setback rules because of my parcel, but for those that do, I like the idea of a ministerial process that is based on sensitive receptors. That makes perfect sense to me.
Okay. Thank you for that, Lee. Rod.
Yeah, it's my understanding that one of the goals of CEQA is to protect agricultural uses and agricultural land. And since hemp is an agricultural product and crop, I would think that it didn't have the CEQA risks that commercial cannabis does, which is an agricultural product at this point. Also, I wanted to mention that there are currently 2,600 cannabis operations in greenhouses around the state and 2,500 outdoor cultivation sites. So the state has experience in the impacts of these types of activities. So you could, you know, as we go on and we have our own CUP process, you'll get the specifications, so you have a way of judging whether something's affecting the receptors. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments from panelists?
John, Mike Cook.
Yeah, please.
Regarding setbacks, you know, just researching some of the other counties during their board meetings when they were adopting ordinances, especially in the great large vineyard communities, there is a enormous amount of pushback from the wineries and the grape growers because they have large venues there, such as weddings and parties and whatnot. So I can imagine a lot of the ag land will border probably a lot of our vineyards and wineries. That being said, they received an enormous amount of pushback from the wine growers because of the smell. There were some counties who were very concerned regarding the terpene tainting the taste of the grapes. So I would strongly consider that within especially a well-established industry like the winery industry that we have here in county. So the setbacks, I think there's definitely a need for setbacks.
Okay. So it could be sensitive receptors and other ag products other than hemp that might be grown adjacent. So I think that's a good comment. So seeing no more comments, it seems to me like the discussion of maybe establishing setbacks from sensitive receptors where we can define those things, the ministerial part we could do. And then if there are options that would require a conditional use permit, as Lori suggested, maybe that's another set of things that would be dealt with there, which would probably require an inspection. So maybe we could start crafting something in that direction. That's what I tend to hear is consensus here. Is that amenable, or is that the way everybody's kind of thinking? If we go down that route of kind of two levels, ministerial approval and then a conditional use, if you've got things that fall out of that side of that ministerial type setback, sensitive receptors, adjacent ag properties, whatever that list of things are that would be ministerial.
John, this is the sheriff.
Yes.
Just one comment that you made, I want to make sure it doesn't get entered into all this documentation down the road as part of the program, if you guys end up doing that. And that is, you made a comment about the sheriff's office has drones to monitor some of this stuff. Sheriff's office will not be using drones to monitor any of this.
I didn't say they were there to monitor. I said you own drones. That's all. I just identified the departments that have drones. That's all I said, for surveillance purposes. So thank you, John. Okay. And I haven't heard anybody comment on the drones. Maybe that's a bad idea. So thank you, Sheriff. Lee, is your hand up, a residual? Or
it's up. Okay. I just wanted to comment on Lieutenant Cook's comment about terpenes. There are a multitude of actual real scientific studies, which I am more than happy to provide to you. Terpenes do not affect the taste of grapes. That is a wives' tale that the grape growers have tried to propagate, and there is no scientific background or facts that make that statement true. So I'm in agreement with the first part of your comments on doing setbacks, but it's not going to have an effect on an ag property. It just won't.
Okay, so having gone through the panelists' comment, I'm going to look back to Daniel and Charlene. Does the proposal to kind of have a two-level approach, the ministerial things that we can do in a setback, sensitive receptors, competing ag products or whatever it is, define what those might be. For instance, sensitive receptors might be at least a 200-foot setback. Competing ag crops might be 100-foot, whatever it is. But establish some ministerial-type setbacks as best we can define them, and then also provide for a conditional use permit for things that would go beyond that, that we don't want to or can't establish a reasonable setback value at this point in time, because it really does get down to the parcel specific situation. Is that consistent with what you think we can develop here?
Yeah, I think so. And Supervisor Huddle, I also wanted to note that I did do some research on this concept of sensitive receptors. And interestingly enough, it actually comes from laws regulating air quality. And that's where people have kind of lifted it from. And usually it's, for purposes of the health and safety code, it's defined as hospitals, schools, and daycare centers, and the Air Resources Board can create new ones. I have a call out to our local air management district to see if we happen to, I'm not sure how that works in the county, so I asked them if we just have a list of what is a sensitive receptor for purposes of air quality. It doesn't mean we have to use that, but that's where the standard came from. And a lot of counties then kind of latched on to that and used it somewhat similar to say that it's people who are sensitive in the sense of, you know, strong odors, and usually it's just, you know, people who are sensitive to air pollutants and strong odors. And then they usually list children and the elderly and stuff. But one of the things we could, so just to answer Mr. Tenenbaum's question, no, not necessarily, but that's a good question. But what I mean by that is just that the term was first created for purposes of laws dealing with air quality, and it was created to deal with basically either groups of people or locations that are particularly sensitive to air pollutants. Right now, what I wanted to kind of learn more about and why I reached out to the Air District is, like, how are those set out? I mean, we might already have a county list of here are the types of people who are potentially sensitive to air pollutants, and which would be, I would imagine, an objective list, because it would be like, these are the types of people. And I think when I was doing this research, as I saw that, I think other counties kind of took that air quality concept and put it into hemp. It may, you know, we don't necessarily have to, but that's where that concept into. Does that address your question before I go on, Mr. Tenenbaum?
It does, but I've also heard it with regards to telephone communications, 5G towers, all of that sensitive receptors. So I think it's got a broader context than what you're referring to.
Yeah, it might in more common things. I'm in the legal world, it started in the concept of air quality.
Right.
And so it tends to be referred to when people are trying to talk about basically populations that are sensitive towards different issues, usually connected to odor. So.
Okay.
But as far as to how we would craft a sort of ministerial ordinance, one of the things, and I think a lot of counties did this, is they would set their setbacks based on some things. So it could be, you know, X amount of feet from a residential zone. It could be X amount of feet from a sensitive receptor. and you could put that you can put that out there. So,
right. And you know, looking at the comments we got back, Butte County was referenced, and we can always, you know, go back and look at the matrix and try to determine what situation we think that another county's adopted that best fits the kind of setback we're talking about, and then take that in conjunction with the inputs that we have to talk about maybe some alternatives, two different levels or something when we bring it back, you know, setback from adjacent ag crops of 100 feet or 200 feet, you know, and we can talk about the pluses and minuses of that, whatever it may be. Yeah. So that's the thing I'm envisioning, is to try to keep narrowing this down, but provide kind of a range of alternatives when we bring it back in the discussion to try to, you know, round it up to what is the appropriate level for this category, sensitive receptors, adjacent ag crops, schools, you know, which is, I think, a sensitive receptor, but whatever you want to call it. So
sure, of course. That's fine.
And I'm just going to say that I don't like the idea of using the air quality's definition based on past experiences. And it can be exclusive to what in our minds might be sensitive receptors. So I think we really want to be careful about adopting somebody else's definition. Because in my mind, anybody that has a sense of smell is going to be sensitive to this. And I don't think we should exclude folks that aren't children or aren't older. There's a lot of people in the middle that actually have a sense of smell. So let's be careful on that, because my personal situation in my house with my neighbor, and it's not a hemp farm, by the way, you guys, just, you know, completely different.
All right. Very good. And Jennifer, I wanted to give you a chance to comment, since we talked about, you know, you had some things to say about setbacks, and we'd get back to setbacks. Do you have anything to add at this point?
No, I just feel like we definitely need some sort of setback, because I mean, this last, with our situation, it was less than 10 feet off our fence line, and that was definitely too close. So something needs to just be set there. But then our house is off also several thousand feet away from where the grow was, and we had a really bad problem with smell. So I'm not sure how to handle that, because the wind definitely blew it up to our house.
Yeah, the topography, the wind, the normal wind flows, all those kinds of things play a role at some point. So yeah, I appreciate the comments. So, okay. I think we're probably ready to move on then to the last part, which was crop size. And so let me start by saying, you know, based upon the conversation we've had and the inputs that we've received, I'm wondering if, you know, if we're not limiting parcel size, is there any reason to deal with crop size? That's just kind of where I'm coming from. It just, I think it's almost an over constraint in terms of, if somebody has a parcel that's 5 acres, they, you know, I'm okay if they grow 5 acres as long as they're compatible with setbacks and other things. But if they only want to grow 2, that's their choice. And it may be the flattest piece of land, and or they have a water supply or whatever it is. But I'm just questioning whether or not we need to have crop size as a definitive limitation, regulatory type provision within our ordinance. So with that, I'll ask Charlene if she's got thoughts on that.
Well, my only thought is, I mean, I'd hate to limit it, but from different things from other counties, definitely if you've got 300 acres of hemp, you are probably going to have more smell than if you've got, you know, 3 acres. So how we deal with that, I'm not quite sure.
Okay. And that's, yeah, that's a consideration. I don't know if it's ever been measured, the odor, as a function of crop size.
John, Mike Cook.
Mike, John, yes, please.
Mike Cook. So let me just give you an example. And it's all over the internet if you want to look at it. last season in Fresno County, I believe it was 249 acres. It was a licensed hemp grow. Unfortunately, it tested high, so they ended up eradicating it. But nonetheless, they managed to get 10 million plants in 249 acres. Now, it's probably not a growing style everybody would choose, but it's one they did. So that doesn't mean that anybody can do that. And when I say that, these plants were inches apart. How could that possibly be inspected without damaging the plants? One, how could you assure that all of those plants are hemp? So let's narrow this down. Let's just say you did that same planting style, 1 acre. That's still 21,786 plants. that somebody needs to look at and inspect. I think it's impossible to do, because if there's not some kind of area in which you can cultivate a plant so that you can navigate throughout the cultivation site for inspection without causing damage to the plants or breaking plants, we're going to be liable for that. Secondly, it would be inviting the commingling of plants, because how could you possibly get to the center of that crop to assure there's not marijuana in there or male plants in there if you decided not to go with male plants? And then who's going to assure that there's not male plants with just 1 acre at 21,000 plants? It's not even feasible. It's not possible. I mean, how could we do that? So I think crop size and not only crop size, but the distance of what you plant the plants would be important, because you have to be able to navigate through these to inspect these.
So plant density or distance between rows or whatever is what something you think we need to prescribe?
Well, I would strongly think about that, because how are you going to get your personnel in there without causing damage?
Okay.
And would it even be plausible? How would the Ag Department even facilitate doing that on a 1 acre if they decided to grow in that fashion?
Yeah, I don't know.
I mean, it'd be impossible, quite frankly. And if it was 2 acres, we're talking about 43,000 plants. You couldn't put your eyes on them. You couldn't walk through it without damaging it.
Okay, good comments. Sheriff, did you have a comment on this one, crop size?
I just wanted to, I think it was a perfect opportunity to talk about, I mean, we're all moving down this road, and I hear you all moving down this road of establishing an ordinance. Are we even discussing a ban? Has that even been brought up? Mike has a whole litany of the crime, the criminal element that it attracts, and the violence that we've seen across the state and across the nation. You know, Mr. Tannenbaum, you made a comment that there wasn't even a market for hemp. Well, if there's not the market, then why are you guys growing it? I understand, you know, so hopefully someday the CBD values come up to the point where you can make a living at this. But from everything that all the research we've been doing and I've been doing and reading, I agree with you. The value is not there unless it is a THC product. You said here, that's not what I said. And I heard you specifically. You said there's no market for hemp. That's exactly what you said. So given that, Mike has a whole, I don't know if he submitted it into the record or you want him to submit it later or to go over it, but I think that the ban part of it also needs to be part of this conversation. And that goes directly to the crop size. The bigger these crop sizes are, especially if you have a lessened setback where it's visible, where the word can get out that it's there, you're inviting other folks that have no clue that it's not hemp. Even if you placard it all over and put signs that this is a hemp field, hemp garden, hemp grow, this is not THC cannabis. There's still those knuckleheads out there that don't know, don't care, or know that so many of them will be commingling that they're going to go in and take their chances anyway.
Okay, thank you for those thoughts. And we, obviously we do have a ban in place now, but it's a, you know, time limited ban, so. Yeah, we can certainly revisit the banning of hemp in the county. That several counties have done that. The arguments that I've seen of banning hemp in a given county is because it would be in competition with a lot of the other cannabis grows that are very prevalent in some of those counties. At least that's the most recent one I read. So it seems like it might go the other way. If you ban hemp, then you might end up with more of the high THC cannabis, but I don't know. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I've got to jump, so I will circle back with Charlene and catch up on what I missed the rest of the meeting.
Very good. Thank you, David. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
You have a couple hands up too, Rod Miller and Lee.
Right. So let's take Lee first.
Yeah, thank you. First, I just want to respond to the sheriff's comments. I know what I said. What I said was one has to grow a lot of hemp in order to make money. And so to Lieutenant Cook's comments, you know, I want to address that too, so that there's not false information being put out. So as a cannabis grower, we would never grow cannabis mixed into a densely populated hemp field. People that are growing hemp the way that Lieutenant Cook is describing are doing it for fiber only. They're not doing it for flower. People that are growing hemp for flower are going to put proper spacing between their plants. And yes, you could have cannabis plants hidden in there somewhere. And again, if there is a possibility for somebody to do something illegal, there are people that will do that. But that's not everybody. And what I see or what I'm hearing from the sheriff's office is a heavy-handed approach and not one of let's look at the people that are legitimate people that want to do things legally and the right way. But what I'm hearing is let's punish everybody. And I don't think that that's either fair or reasonable. And that's not why we're here. So, there's some comments that are being posted. You know, if you look at what hemp sells for, flower per pound, $40 to $100. So you have to grow a lot of it in order to make money. So, and anyhow, I will stop droning, but I don't like being told what I said and what I didn't say. So I don't appreciate it, Sheriff, that you are falsely putting words in my mouth.
Okay. Thank you, Lee, for your comment. Let's go to Rod.
Yeah, you know, really this county doesn't have a lot of ag land that's good for row crops. So it is good for commercial cannabis, and I really think that's what most people are going to want to do. And when that program works, that's the direction most people will go. You know, this hemp will be a small subset of, you know, folks that are trying to meet the market that the governor is trying to create, a manufactured market. So, I mean, I really think that we have a lot more meritorious, positive sort of community effect by, having the commercial cannabis program work and, you know, shining a light of day, showing that people can be responsible. And that creates a natural dynamic where the folks like Lee that really want to be responsible will help law enforcement find, without as much trouble as they have now, the folks that aren't legal. So, I mean, I think we can really work together as a community to have these types of policies be a positive for our community. We don't have to always be in conflict. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Lee. Or Rod, excuse me. So I would like to circle back to Lieutenant Cook. Would you submit your thoughts in writing for the record? If you'd submit those to Myrna, and please include the sheriff's comments if you can, so that goes as part of the public record of the discussion. Because I think that's important to make sure those get put into, you know, the appropriate documentation. So,
yes, I will. And he mentioned a PowerPoint that I have and just didn't make today. And I promise that I'll have it for the next meeting, which will cover a lot of what we've talked about.
All right, very good. Any other final thoughts or comments on crops? Excuse me. I turned the page on crop size.
Right.
Limitations. Lori, did you have some? Sorry.
Well, a lot of the comments didn't really relate to crop size. I think we got off topic a little bit. So I just want to get back to basically what Charlene started off with is that it does make sense that the more you have, the bigger the crop size, the more odor is going to be produced. I mean, that just makes sense. So somehow that needs to be, you know, as long as the parcel size and setbacks or whatever we do addresses that, I think that will naturally limit the crop size perhaps. But that's going to be a factor, really it is. The bigger the crop, the more it's going to smell. It just makes sense. So we'll see if the other criteria that we're looking at, maybe that'll naturally take care of it. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't know either, but I guess what we're saying is there may be a maximum crop size that we would want to establish if we determine that, you know, the odor part of it is extreme when you get more than a 50 acre grow. But again, if there's nobody adjacent to it for miles and miles and miles, if it's only the wildlife, does that a conflict with, you know, being able to grow it in that kind of an environment? So again, I think it becomes site specific.
That's the checklist right there.
Right.
how far away is it? If it's next to forest land, there's not a sensitive receptor there. So that to me is the checklist. Makes sense.
Okay, very good. Appreciate that.
And I was just going to follow up with that is that I would be happy to sort of work on maybe some, you know, draft language of what we're looking at so far and try to get that together to you so we can have a sense on with maybe some options there of like different ways we could approach the setback. If that might be, if you'd like me to do that, I'm more than happy to do so.
Please, Daniel, that would help if you kind of synthesize the thoughts here and bring it back together. So I think Rod had another comment. Rod, you're muted.
Yeah. You know, again, one of the benefits of having these programs is you'll gain real world experience about what the actual impacts are. When you look at the engineering analysis for how the odor can move towards the property lines, you know, there's plumes, and just like you're saying, there's all kinds of environmental factors. Are there, like, one of the things that they noticed in doing the assessment was folks that had vineyards around their cannabis didn't have as much odor at the property line. The terpenes reacted, you know, were stirred up by the air, reacted, oxidized, or whatever the process was. It reduced. Same if it's going through a whole forest of trees, it's going to interact with the tree terpenes, and you know, it's a dynamic process, but it can be measured. The county has a standard, the 7DT standard. So I mean, like Leah's saying, we have experience, we can get to objective standards that, you know, will protect everybody, you know, equally and fairly.
Thank you. And that, you know, we've recognized there are mitigation measures for odor and that sort of thing, misters, but I think those end up, in some cases, might be very expensive to try to implement in a large agricultural setting where you don't have a lot of power and other things readily available. So, anyway, so that's another topic, though, mitigation of some of these things. And that might get into the conditional use permit type of things that you would have to mitigate by applying these misters or whatever. If you do have a boundary that's sensitive and you want to fight for that setback being reduced, that's the kind of thing that you'd have to argue is you're able to implement that effectively and that mitigation will work. And you know, that kind of goes into the CEQA.
Right? Pre-op to be perfect. Yeah, that's exactly what it is. Like if you, that's where you would start getting into CEQA if you talk about mitigation measures, is that you would have a, you know, you would do steps to do that. And that's where, you know, if we went that way, there's risk and benefits and, you know, from each both approach, but I'm going to proceed in how I've been drafting things to assume that we're going a ministerial way. The board may choose to deviate from that at a later point, of course, but that's how I'm approaching so far.
Very good. So I do want to just circle back on one comment that was made, and I'm not sure it applies, but there was a comment requesting, please ban the growing of male hemp plants except for indoor breeding projects. And I'm not sure, do we want to try to enforce something like that? Because we know occasionally there may be a male hemp plant and you know, the growers are out there removing those because they don't want the intrusion, the conflict between the male and the female plant. Is that something that we should consider as,
hey John,
as a regulation?
If you look at the agenda, I believe that might be in number 3A. That kind of stuff fits into there, which I'm not really sure. Are we discussing this stuff today, or is this something we're going to be discussing?
I think we're going to discuss part of it. I'm not sure we're going to get through all of it, but this was a comment that was made on crop size. So that's the only reason I mentioned it. It was put in the table affecting crop size. So we can certainly look at it at a later point in time.
Well, that could be something we handle with BMPs, that, you know, best management practices is that you go and you rogue your male plants out, you know, and as we go out for whatever types of inspections, we will also be looking for, you know, are you doing that kind of thing.
And Charlene, help me, is there a document that we use for best management practices?
We don't have one currently, but there are other counties that do.
Okay, so we might be able to adopt something somebody else has already put out relative to hemp specific, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay, that's good to know. All right, so I think we've concluded our revisit and we've narrowed the set of variables a little bit here with the discussion. Daniel's going to take and draft some things and we'll bring that back for discussion relative to the wording. So I'm going to move on to item three, which is discussion of the next steps. And I guess I'm going to ask, we're at 4:18. How much longer are people able to stay with us? I think my calendar showed 3 hours, but I'm not sure everybody wants to hang that long and go through this. Lori, are you available if we go on for another, say, hour or 45 minutes or something like that?
I can go till 5 probably comfortably. Okay. I just don't know if everybody did research in the ICE items. You're kind of on the next. So just,
right. I think this is going to, the next section is really going to be a general discussion because I don't think we dealt with a lot of these in terms of the county comparison matrix that we had. I think they're really more open for discussion. So some of them we can have a brief discussion table and then bring it back to a broader discussion. Some of them we may be able to dispense with for instance, fees. I mean, that's a never ending discussion, right? So we started somewhere, but we're not going to resolve it today because it all comes down to what is the cost of service from our ag commissioner and her staff and stuff and other things that we might have to do, clean up when somebody abandons a grow or something or other. We've got to go somebody out, you know, send somebody out there and pay to have that done. So that's got to be covered. So there's a whole lengthy discussion, I'm sure, with fees. But if we all agree to stay till 5 o'clock, I think that's probably a reasonable time frame to do this. And so with that, let's move on to what we call those next steps for the hemp. And the first one listed is industrial hemp breeders and cultivation, indoor operations only to prevent pollen. So Charlene, you obviously had some specific thoughts there.
Well, and the whole point of usually the hemp breeders, excuse me, is they are developing new strains. So they're not going to want to have pollen from the person who has their 6 plants next door or whatever coming in and mixing in with what they're trying to do. So my thought here was that probably most hemp breeders are going to want to have things probably in an enclosed greenhouse or something similar. I might hear different from our panel, but and that also, if that is kept indoors, would also protect anybody who is working with, you know, cannabis if they're doing certain strains too. So,
yeah, Daniel, your thoughts on this one?
I don't really have anything to add, so I think that's
okay. Lori?
No, that makes sense because maybe somebody that is a grower could clarify, but if you're doing breeding, you're not going to have acres and acres, right? You're going to be having the smaller, so that does make sense.
Yeah, and I agree. I think it makes sense to, you know, those have to be indoor, prevent pollen spread, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's pretty much the standard at which it's done, unless there's some new technique developed or something. But okay, so with that, let's open it up for any of the other panelists' comments on this particular item, industrial hemp breeders and cultivation. Rod.
Yeah, it's a good practice to set a rule when you're doing this to prevent the growing of male plants. Just that'll reduce conflict between hemp growers and commercial cannabis growers. Believe it or not, that happens. The hemp folks are represented by one set of people and the commercial cannabis people are represented by another set of interest groups. And eventually that'll happen here. And there's some thoughts that pollen could have some liability issues if they affect a commercial cannabis crop. So just, I think it'll put your ordinance future forward by preventing the growing of male plants.
Okay, thank you for that. Phil?
Feminized seed is pretty much a standard practice in the industry. That's why we use it. Male plants in the field hurt the hemp farmers as much as it would hurt the cannabis farmers. We don't want to see that. I have colleagues in Virginia that are currently working on seed breeding projects. They do it all inside of controlled environment greenhouses with HEPA filters, as well as indoor practices. and I've visited a very large scale seed breeding facility at Ventura Seeds in Ventura, California, and they're following those same practices. So that's, it seems pretty much to be the industry standard.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
So not seeing any other panelists comments on this one, I think we'll just take that as, yes.
Before you move on, it just dawned on me, you know, we were talking about setbacks and all that stuff up above and the agenda, but now that we're talking about the breeding and the, you know, the male and female plants and all that stuff and pollen, it just dawned on me, should we have some kind of a setback for when the commercial cannabis gets going and lights and sights and stuff? Shouldn't we have a setback that we don't want hemp farms so close to the licensed cannabis? Is that a thing? Because you don't want those two next to each other, or is it just the male plant? As long as the male plants are picked out, it's okay with the hemp. Is that right? Rod, do you know that one?
Yeah, I would say that's correct. I mean, if you wanted to keep the hemp farmers away from the commercial cannabis farmers, I think that would work. But
okay.
Is there a requirement to do that because of crop destruction or crop influence? Can you grow hemp right next to normal high THC cannabis and not have an impact if it's not male plants?
Right. Yes, you can grow them together if they're not male plants. Yes, absolutely.
That's what I thought. So,
okay.
That's a reasonable comment. So very good. So I'm going to move on. Go ahead. Okay. Let's move on to testing, additional testing allowed by agricultural or the sheriff. So Charlene, thoughts on this one?
So I know a lot of counties have some additional things in their ordinance to allow, on-site inspections from the ag department or sheriff or planning, which could include additional testing. So I would like some feedback from the panel.
Okay. And let's take comments from Lieutenant Cook or the sheriff before we open it up to the panel. So your thoughts, Lieutenant Cook.
So I would leave it open to allowing the sheriff's office to do so as part of the ordinance, but and the reason being, we have a lot more to do than go test hemp grows all day long. That's not something that's going to be a priority to us, but it does give us stability if we're getting a strong, reasonable suspicion, probable cause to believe that there might be some criminal activity or wrongdoings there. That gives us the ability to go in and double check that.
Okay, so without any kind of a warrant or anything else, just allow it by ordinance? Is that what we're talking about?
If that's possible.
Periodic inspection.
But I don't know that that's possible with the sheriff's office. I've seen other counties and read some that's part of the permitting process, but I think I would have to ask county council if that would be possible.
Then you'll have to weigh in on that one when we get to writing something. Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
I can comment on that a little bit if you'd like me to.
Yes, please.
So there is actually a line of case law referring to what is called administrative searches. And what that allows is that you can do searches of what are called closely regulated industries. Interestingly enough, the case law began with pawn shops and junk dealers, because they were at that time industries that were known as being connected to criminal activity. And it's more broader than that over time, but that was the beginning of it. And what you want to do when structuring that is you need to make sure that usually how those work is that they're usually random and they're based on something. So like once a month we search someone. But the thing we want to avoid there is we don't want it to be, if you have particular suspicion of a particular person, the administrative search isn't really for that. Now that being said, if you're doing these regular searches and you do whatever way we do them, once a month, every couple of weeks, and you uncover something, that is something you could use in a criminal trial. It's a complicated thing, and I'm certainly aware of that and want to look into that. And I'd, of course, if the sheriff's office wants to talk with me about it too, I'm more than happy to hear their perspective, and either we can structure this in a way that balances everyone. So,
okay, thank you. Lori, do you have any thoughts on this one? I think it's absolutely required, but how we do it within the legal grounds.
Yeah.
And then you get into, does it require pre-notification? I don't think so. I think it can be random.
Usually the case law says that, well, so like most things in con law, what I always refer to it as is like it's a spectrum of how close you are to getting an issue. Generally, the case law says, you know, if you have some pre-notification, courts tend to like that. They don't always require it. But they also say the pre-notification could be the morning of. It doesn't require like that. Or you could do more. I mean, it's entirely that. And I also say that those usually do require that it's, you know, within business hours. It's not at, you know, 2 a.m. or something.
Yeah, it's
done within a certain scheme. So, and okay. The state regulations, as they're currently drafted, do at least contemplate that, you know, there's that one section I put up in one of my slides that they contemplate there will be annual inspections. And so we could sort of add on to that. We're doing it carefully to avoid issues. So.
Thank you. Lori, do you have any other additional comments on that?
No, just that the you know, I only talked to a few of the farmers last year, and I think everyone I talked to just said that, you know, if the sheriff wanted to come out, just call and say, hey, we're coming out. And, you know, nobody really seemed to have, at least the people I talked to didn't seem to have concerns about it. So that random administrative search might be a good thing to write into the, because then it, you know, with the randomness of it all, you're not picking on anyone. And then if there's suspicion of criminal activity, that's a whole different ball of wax. That, right. So,
yep.
Yeah, they have actual probable cause, and this is only on top of the normal process. Anything where there's probable cause or ability to go warrant for other reasons, that still applies.
Okay.
Okay, so let's open it up to panelists. Lee.
Yeah, this is my personal opinion. I have absolutely no problem whatsoever with having the sheriff or anybody else come to my site. I'm not doing anything wrong. I would like common courtesy, though, because we are a secure site, and I don't want people just rolling up. But if the sheriff's office or anybody else from the county wants to come out and do an inspection, I personally have no problem with that whatsoever.
All right. Very good. Rod.
Most regulatory inspections are usually have some notice, just as common courtesy, you know. People are running large operations, complex operations, and, you know, it can be disruptive. So, I mean, one of the issues is kind of, are people operating in good faith? Are they being reasonable that, you know, they're not just harassing cannabis growers because they're cannabis growers? I mean, we have this current kind of distrust of different groups here. That's one of the things that we need to get over and work together. So if it's a reasonable type process, fine. But if it's harassing cannabis folks just because they're cannabis growers, you know, you're going to get pushback.
Okay, understand. Tom, you have your hand up, I believe.
Yes, I agree with Lee's comments. You know, I, as a hemp grower last year, I, you know, invited people to come out and check it out, and including the sheriff or whoever. And I've said this before, I think that as a practical matter, if you're going to grow cannabis, the last place you want to do it is in a hemp, registered hemp field where you get tested, and everyone that did it last year got caught. So I don't think people are going to do that because you risk losing your own crop. So I have no problem with the sheriff coming out anytime.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. I think Ruben, yes.
I also don't have any problems with having the sheriff's department come out. Again, I have a grow over here in Lotus. The only thing that I would ask is that we have some sort of procedure as to how the plant is tested, because when Charlene comes out, the state mandates that you test this percentage and this distance from the top, this distance from the sides. So as long as we're all testing to the same standards, then there should never be a problem. That's my only comment.
Okay. I'm not seeing any other thoughts on that. So I think that was a good roundtable discussion on the testing. And I'm sure, Dan, you probably got some thoughts on how we could wrap that into the legal aspects of this and define whether we're really emphasizing random or prior notification, recognizing it can be the morning of. Yeah. So we just have to kind of walk through those things and determine what we think is the reasonableness of it and protects the grower's rights and the ability to be there when something happens and, you know, that mm-hmm. part of it. So very good. So I think I'm going to move on to the next item then, which is security. So Charlene, your thought on this one?
Well, this is one where I would say really only a few counties did this. But that being said, you know, is it best that there's at least fencing around it that's secure when nobody's on site? You know, should there be some cameras or, you know, since in some counties there are still some issues with theft, you know, so how, well, and I'd like the sheriff's, you know, take on this too, but what should be a standard?
Okay. And Daniel, your thoughts of any?
No, I think she covered that. I just, one thing when I spoke to Myrna about this item, I thought it was also going to be about the posting of security for abatement, which is a bond. That is another thing that some counties do, just to note that that's something we could, it's something maybe it's a bad day, but just noting that. So.
Okay, Lori.
This one I haven't really looked into, so I'm sorry I don't have any.
Okay, and my only thought is since the hemp looks an awful lot like marijuana and we know there's a theft problem with the marijuana, that there may be people who think they're harvesting something to take it to market only to find out after the fact it's not what they thought it was. So from that perspective, the security risk is mostly on the grower, on the owner of the property in terms of loss, but it could also you know, result in calls to the sheriff's department with the response and who knows what happens with all those things. So I would very much like to hear from Mike Cook and what's what the thought is from the sheriff's office at this point.
So John, maybe just to speed things up, we can wait till the next meeting and I'm gonna cover this with a PowerPoint.
Okay.
I think that would kick off a great discussion on maybe safety and security for everybody with what's going on, just not regionally here, but nationally, because they're growing all over the states now. And even internationally, I have some stats, but that might be a better time to do it, and it'll speed things.
Okay, all right. So we'll defer your comments so we get to that. So I'm going to open it up for panel comments. Anybody want to comment on security at this point? Rod.
One of the issues is the cost of the security features, since hemp is a low-value crop. If you require chain-link fencing versus field game fencing, you know, that make the cost of running an operation prohibitive. I mean, most ag operations have some kind of deer game fencing to prevent deer, obviously, from eating their crops. So that is a barrier. It's not the same as chain link, but I mean, the hazards of hemp are insignificant. So I would try to keep the cost down would be a good idea.
Okay, very good. So next category is fees, and I'm going to suggest we defer fees. Susan Robin, I didn't see your hand until now, so please.
If we go down the road of cameras, which I don't think it's a good idea, I've installed camera systems for the military, for the government. Just be aware that's going to be a huge cost increase for each of the growers, because you can have a camera out there, and yes, from 200 feet or 300 feet away, you may be able to see an object moving across there, but you're not going to get facial recognition off of anything. So cameras in a large scale operation, unless you really invest a huge amount of money, they're going to be useless. So it really, I believe, should be up to the growers themselves if they choose to protect their crop. Now, I agree with fencing, but I don't know what restrictions should be put on that.
All right, very good. Okay, so seeing no more panelist comments, I'm going to suggest we defer fees, because that's kind of where I think we end up. If we're going to have an ordinance and get to that point, Then we've got to understand what the cost of service is for the various elements of the county that's involved and other things before we would establish fees. So I'm going to defer that one. I think it's going to be a lengthy discussion if and when we get to that level of discussion. So if that's okay with everybody, I'd like to move on to item E, the county permits for licensing, agricultural and or planning. We've had some discussion already on some of that, but Charlene, anything specific in this category you want to bring up?
Just the fact that most counties do have this extra level of either permitting or licensing, that it seems to be almost interchangeable use unless they require special use permits. And that gives the county some control, because otherwise everything is falls under the state regulations, which only touch on, you know, violations somewhat as far as what can be done. Wherein I think if we have this extra level, if we do have somebody that does illegal activity, then we can keep, you know, prohibit them from being in the program for, you know, X amount of time, whatever we come up with. And it makes it easier, I think, than if we just have the state rules.
Right, but I want to make sure from a clarity perspective, I understand that, you know, the current hemp grows that we've had, we have issued a permit for it, correct?
Registration. It's called registration.
But not a permit. So yes. It goes beyond just registration with a permit. All right, got it. And or licensing and then and or planning. And I assume the planning might refer to things like CEQA, or is that something different?
Yeah, and I was putting that in there in case we went down the road of special use permits or something.
Okay, got it. As applicable to special use permit. Okay. Daniel, any comments on this one?
No, I mean, I think Shirley hit on that. I mean, I think that it's an interesting way on how hemp works, you know, comparison to cannabis, where you have a state cannabis license. We don't have a state hemp license. We do have a registration that is governed by state law, but issued by the local government. So we'll have, there'll be that. And in addition to that, there'll be a permit, which I think is what we talked about before. And if we went down the route of a conditional permit, use permit, there potentially, I guess, be three permits. But that would be, which I did see some counties did, but that would be a question. So I think what we're looking at so far is you have, you know, your state registration, which is just the state process, and the local thing on top of that, and that's really enacted pursuant to our local land use powers.
Okay, thank you. Lori, any comments on this one?
No, nothing to add.
Okay, and I don't either. Lieutenant Cook, excuse me. Lieutenant Cook, any comments on this one?
I'm sorry, John, what was the question? I was small.
This is dealing with county permits, licensing agreements, and or planning associated with that. Do you have any comments relative to the county wanting to establish a separate permit in addition to registration?
Oh, I think they should.
Yeah. Okay.
With a background.
All right, very good. So with that, let's open it up to panelists' comments. Any panelists' comments on county permits, licensing, agriculture, and or planning? Okay, I'm not seeing any. It must be getting late in the afternoon. Oh, I'm sorry, Lee.
I was laughing. I have no issue with obtaining a permit, but I would like the decision makers to take into account that hemp is a very low value product, and increasing the fees continually is going to keep people out. I do not feel that an additional background check is necessary, since we have to do one anyway for the Ag Department, but having to do a second one, as Lieutenant Cook suggests, if that's what his intent was, does not make sense to me.
Okay, so noted. Any other panelists' comments on this one? Not seeing any, then let's go to the last category. Illegal activity on registered hemp parcel cannabis or hemp prohibit participation for X time. And I guess I don't understand what X time is. So well, Darlene, can you help me with that one?
Well, that it kind of left that open. You know, some counties may say a year, some may say 3 years. I've seen it even as high as 5 years that you would have to be banned for the participation in the program if you had illegal grows along with your hemp. And maybe Daniel has some something to add with this as far as legality of doing these kinds of things.
I think it's, you know, just within the discretion of the board about whether they chose to do so. Other counties do that. Not everyone does. It would be essentially what you look at is that it would be, you know, if you were someone who had been found to have been in violation of our local rules, then, you know, potentially, I guess, a punishment attached to that would be to ban you from getting a hemp permanent. That's something that you look at. And that, you know, there could be some nuances to that we don't necessarily need to think about today, but that's something to think about, yes.
So Daniel, that would normally go with the operator, the grower, whatever, and not the property, not the parcel, because I can see where parcels could change hands and you get into a shell game, right? So
yeah, it would be the operator that I would attach to. It would be, I think what how I saw it normally drafted, if it was in the standards for how you look at an application, and one of the reasons to deny an application would be that some prior. And I would assume that we mean a violation that's like, you know, formally found an issue, something from code enforcement or something of that nature.
Yep. Okay. I understand it better now. So Lori, do you have any thoughts on this one?
Yeah. Thank you for the clarification, Charlene. Yeah. It makes sense to come up with some kind of time period.
Yep. And I agree. We just need to decide what that is and how we enforce it. Cause that's the other thing. If we're not out doing inspections or something or other periodic drive-bys, whatever, how do you know what's going on in a given parcel in a remote part of El Dorado County? Maybe somebody knows, but I have no idea how you know. So, okay. And Lieutenant Cook, your thoughts, if any, on this?
On the enforcement?
Yes.
Well,
the banning or the restriction of growing for a given operator if they're found to be in conflict and non-compliance with, you know, the ordinance that we have, how long and what other punitive measures might be incorporated in an ordinance?
Well, I always believe in second chances. I don't think somebody should be punished for the rest of their life for a mistake. However, if it's a simple slap on the wrist and a citation or a small fine, then what's the point? I think it would have to be punitive enough to kind of get their attention and maybe get the attention of others. If you're going to take corrective action, the idea is to not only correct the wrongdoing, but to spread the message that's inappropriate behavior, right? I don't feel like I'm the right one to weigh on a judgment on somebody, but I think there should be something that gets everybody's attention that do it right or you're not going to do it at all.
Okay. So with that, I see Rod's got his hand up, so we'll take panelists' comments at this point. Rod?
Yeah, I think we need some clear definition of what you mean by illegal activity. Are you talking about somebody that has a 1.5% and they under the new federal regs, they aren't able to remediate it as a total plant, and then they get hit with some outrageous fine? Or if we're talking about they're growing commercial cannabis or, you know, THC cannabis in the hemp, then the existing law, the misdemeanors for cultivation would apply. So, perhaps being banned for the next year if they're doing something like not having a fence or, you know, but I think there's existing criminal penalties for most of the cannabis-related illegal activity. There's plenty of criminal rules that apply to cannabis still.
Well, Rod, I don't believe I provided an answer. I just suggested that, you know, there should be something, at least enough to keep everybody on the level, you know what I mean? And I don't know the answer to that. Perhaps I'm not the one. I enforce laws. I don't judge folks. So, but if we're going to take some kind of corrective action, it would have to be sufficient enough to assure that it wouldn't reoccur and pass the message throughout the community that it would probably be a bad idea. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. And obviously we're going to have to research a little bit more and discuss.
I can do one thing is that the way the hemp registrations work is that if you're convicted of a felony to do with any sort of drug activity, you're preempted from being in the program for 10 years. Now, if it's just a misdemeanor, you can still do it. So I think that makes it a little tough if we do find cannabis in a hemp grow, and then it makes it hard to make it a felony, then there's nothing to preempt them from going and registering the next year. So I think we need to make sure that we have something strong enough that if this happens, you know, no matter how they get convicted or if they get convicted, that they can't do it again for some period of time.
I just wanted to add on to that, that when, how Mick said, other counties approach in different ways, and some, and one of the things that they talk about is not just criminal enforcement, but it's someone who had an administrative enforcement, which means it's usually through the code enforcement process where they're found to have a violation, and you know, there could be, you know, technical violations, maybe it doesn't make sense to do that, that's, you know, within the discretion of the board. But it would look at, you know, maybe potential particular type of code enforcement action could also result in a, you know, a ban from a local permit and for some excess money or something. But
yeah. Yeah, and Ruben had a comment, I think, too.
Yes, thank you. I agree completely. As one of the people who are trying to do this legally and correctly, I think if someone is caught doing something incorrectly, that they should lose the ability to be able to grow again next year. I guess my only concern is, and it's my concern every year when I'm growing, is that if for whatever reason I were to get a strain that goes over, I can't remember who alluded to it earlier, but if I get a strain that actually tests hotter than what the state allows now, that's not, again, I don't know the verbiage on what would be criminal activity versus negligence, but if I went over that, I wouldn't, of course, would be happy to remediate or destroy the crop, whatever's the appropriate measure, but I don't want to lose my license next year for having a strain that is beyond my control that went over a certain percentage.
Yeah, I just read Lee's chat comment on this. You know, that it seems the intent is for people growing cannabis on their hemp permit, not hot plants. There are also things in place to handle it. So, yeah, and I think that's consistent with your comments. A person shouldn't be arbitrarily restricted because of one hot plant or several hot plants that weren't intended. Somehow that happens. You know, it's more really the violation with respect to the high THC cannabis grows, intentional, et cetera. But we're going to have to weed through all that and make a determination and whatever we might put in here as to how that would apply. You know, what is inside the boundaries? What is outside the boundaries? Try to make it very specific so that people would understand what that penalty, what that punitive action might amount to given, you know, set of conditions. So that's what's going to be tough to write up, Daniel. I can see an infinite number of possibilities here, but because illegal activity, yeah, wow, that's a pretty widespread.
Yeah, I think that this kind of question, we won't really know exactly how we're going to handle that till we really tackle on exactly what the enforcement scheme is. But, you know, there are options to go forward and how we could do that. And, you know, we can, that's something that I need to think about more. But there's a process. So, yeah.
I think all agree there should be something in there. We just need to figure out how to apply it and make it, you know, reasonable, but yet punitive enough for people who intentionally violate things and intentionally do things illegally to suffer consequences. So, Lee, you had another thought here?
Yeah, just real quick. So I'm totally in favor of punishing people that are doing things illegally, but to Ruben's point and some of the others, if we are a hemp grower and we have hot plants, there's things to remediate or destroy that. And I'm in agreement that we're not doing anything illegal. We just had a bad strain or a hot strain. And so I guess I'm looking for feedback from the sheriff's office to find out if Lieutenant Cook has an opinion. I'm not looking for how we penalize, that is to minds greater than mine, but I'm curious what the sheriff's office opinion is on hot plants versus illegal activity like growing cannabis, which would be, you know, say 20x the THC level of a hemp plant.
Well, look, if they're 20, then that case, they're going to get eradicated, and that case is going to go to the DA's office for cultivation of marijuana if it's over six plants, right? So there's your answer. You're going to have a criminal case. What the DA's office does with it is, you know, beyond me. But on that note, you know, we're going to have parcels now that will be allowed to have six plants per parcel as far as marijuana. So perhaps if we continue to go down this road and we're going to have cultivation of hemp, I think we should define, if you're going to grow six plants, it would be easier for the sheriff's office to probably create a whole lot less problem for the cultivator if the six plants were cultivated maybe separately from the hemp instead of in the middle of the grow. So if we see this on an overflight and it's clearly marijuana and we're going to show up and we find it's just their six plants they're allowed to have, it's a waste of everybody's time. But on a quick flyover, I might not know it's just six. I just see a difference in the plants and we're going to return with a search warrant and we might find out it's six plants they're allowed to have. So if it's, you know, cultivated in a different area, that might alleviate a lot of confusion and I'm wasting everybody's time. So does that answer your question, Lee, as far as, I mean, whether they're hot plants or intentionally commingled, it could end up going criminal or, and that would, it's up to the DA.
It does, but I'm trying to put a fine point on it for everybody. So if, and I don't live on my growing property, so I'm less concerned with having six cannabis plants. We're talking about people that are willingly violating their hemp permit by commingling cannabis versus I'm only cannabis and I have a plant that tests out higher than the 0.3 or 0.1%. There's remediation or laws that are already enforced by ag on how to deal with that. And I would not want someone who did that by mistake versus on purpose to be penalized. And again, not dealing with the penalty, but I just want to understand, you know, if I have a crop that's at 1.5%, I have to destroy it. It's cannabis, but it's not something that would even be remotely able to be sold illegally or legally as cannabis.
So I would just tell you that my directions to my narcotics officers and my sergeant over there, that it has to be fairly significant before you even consider going criminal on this. If it appears to be a mistake, if we're talking a point or two, probably something we would hand over to the ag department to deal with. I don't know that we're gonna get into splitting hairs, but if it's obviously, you know, well over, then we will probably deal with a criminal.
Okay, that makes perfect sense to me. Thank you.
Yeah, and I was just going to mark beyond that just to make sure that there will be an administrative enforcement scheme that is separate from the criminal enforcement scheme, and that goes through code enforcement. Administrative enforcement does also have a hearing on it. Does have a thing like that happen through code enforcement violations, but. There could be where you could get a violation there, and that's where we're far away from making that decision right now. But that's something I want to think about is that, you know, what category of enforcement would be the type of thing that would result in a consequence in the future. So,
thank you, Daniel. So I'm not seeing any other comments, and we're almost at 5 o'clock. So I'm just going to ask any go backs on something that. Somebody remembered they wanted to add before we kind of close the public record part of the discussion here. All right, seeing that, I want to thank you all for your participation again. I think we're making good progress. Obviously, we knew this was going to take a while, but I think all the commentary is helpful and the collection into the matrix of comments and stuff, I think is also extremely helpful. And Daniel putting together some drafts of some of the things we've talked about to start converging some of these down to a minimum set of alternatives and stuff, I think that will all also be very helpful when it comes down to weighing in again. So Myrna, are you still on? Do you have, yeah, I see it.
Yeah, I have that one comment.
Okay. Do you have an expectation of when we would meet again? That's what I was just thinking of, you know, next steps. Are we going to meet 3 weeks from now? I don't know if anything calendared, but have you got any thoughts on that?
3 weeks from now would be good.
All right.
If you guys are in agreement on that, on the 24th.
I'd have to look. I'll look real quick.
24th or 25th. I do have a Fish and Game Commission meeting at 6. As long as you didn't run over, we could do it.
See, the 24th would work for me. The 25th will not. So.
Okay. What about Lori?
We'd have to be done by 5:30 on the 24th because I do have LAFCO.
But yes.
If we went from 3 to 5 again, that would work fine for me on the 24th. Lori, do you have a chance to look at your calendar?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if the – is the Cemetery Advisory Committee meeting yet? That's on there, but I haven't heard anything yet.
I don't know.
Yeah, I have that on my calendar, but as like a placeholder. But other than that – and I guess I could miss him.
Well, let's just tentatively agree 3 weeks from today, roughly. Either sounds like the 24th would be the preferred date, but if we have to, we can move to a different date. But let's at least target that. And Lori, that'll give you some time, I think, to follow up and find out if the cemetery committee is meeting or not. I haven't heard, so.
Yeah, I know.
And Myrna, if it doesn't work, we'll get back with you to try to give you our calendar dates that work in that kind of a time frame and kind of work it at your level, first of all, and then we'll go ahead and put the notification out to others. Hopefully we'll be able to participate. So.
Sounds great. And the comment I had, it kind of will go just along with your meeting next week. It was from Casey, and basically he was just saying that be careful about the proposals you're discussing today. So I think he'll be able to comment at the next meeting, and I'll get that out to public comment for all of you. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. So with that, it's right at 5:00. I appreciate everybody's participation. Again, I think we did a good job of getting through a lot of information. So thank you again for your attendance, and we'll see you hopefully in 3 weeks. And if not, we'll find another date that works for everybody and get back to you. So.
Very good. All right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.